May it please the court. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal argument, and I plan to focus my argument on the Fifth Amendment issues that were raised in the briefs. There are two statements that were admitted in violation of Mr. Brinson Scott's Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Mr. Scott answered a knock on the door, and he opened the door to 10 to 12 officers who came in. They handcuffed him, made him sit in a chair, and two officers stood guard over him, while the remaining 8 to 10 officers searched the apartment.
They told him he wasn't under arrest, right? That's a critical factor here, isn't it?
There was some differing evidence from the government. There was one officer who testified that in the normal course of an arrest, that is part of what they do, that they tell the person they're executing a search warrant, they're not under arrest, they're being handcuffed for
officer
safety.
But the search warrant wasn't even for this guy, number one, and wasn't for drugs. It was for the guns of his brother.
That's correct.
All right, so he wasn't even a suspect. He was put in a chair and handcuffed because they were looking for guns.
That's correct.
All right.
That's correct. That officer testified that that was the normal police procedure, and that was done in this case. Another officer was asked whether or not he was specifically told he was not under arrest. That officer
He had been arrested before, hadn't he? I mean, he had been through the drill of being Mirandized before, hadn't he?
That could be inferred, perhaps. I don't know in the record whether that's the case or not. It's true that he had been arrested before. I don't know if in his prior arrests he had actually received Miranda warnings. But in this case, regardless, whether or not he was advised that he was under arrest or not is not necessarily dispositive. And I would
Almost nothing is this. No single factor is dispositive in any of this, right?
Well, that's correct.
What evidence do you have that it was anything other than the Summers detention?
This was
at that point when they put him in a chair and handcuff him.
Summers deals with what is reasonable for police officers to do when executing a search warrant. We have no quarrel with what the officers actually did. I point out the facts because the test, getting to the Miranda issue, there must be custody and there must be police interrogation. And the test on whether or not there was custody is whether or not there was a restraint on freedom of movement of the degree associated with the formal arrest. And the Summers case deals with, and a lot of the Fourth Amendment cases deal with what is a reasonable seizure. In this case, we're dealing with the Fifth Amendment. And the custody question is whether there's a restraint on freedom of movement of the degree associated with the formal arrest. And there was in this case. Mr. Brinson Scott was in custody. We're not raising a Fourth Amendment issue as to whether or not it was unreasonable or reasonable to have handcuffed him. That's not the issue that we have raised in the brief. The issue is whether or not his Fifth Amendment rights were violated by the questioning that took place under those custodial conditions. He made three statements that are at issue in this appeal. First, he was asked which bedroom was his. And he nodded to the left bedroom and answered verbally.
Let me back up. I mean, the really key issue here is whether there was a custodial interrogation, right? And what is beyond the handcuffing, which is not dispositive in and of itself, right? It's only one factor to look at. Beyond the handcuffing, what was it about this questioning that rises to the level of a custodial interrogation under Miranda and its progeny?
Well, the
handcuffing, to be sure. Was there anything else?
There was the number of officers that, well,
why,
okay.
Why would that make a difference?
Well, it goes to the restraint on freedom of movement. And the number of officers, the fact that he was not free to move about, he had to sit in the chair And he had two officers standing guard over him.
That's going to be true any time there's some sort of custodial detainment during a search warrant, right? I mean, that's the whole point, officer safety. You stay right there, we're going to handcuff you while we conduct the search. So that's going to happen any time you have a search warrant where officer safety is at issue, right?
That could be the case. And again, we're not raising a Fourth Amendment issue that was improper. It's an issue of
whether it creates a custodial interrogation, right? And you're saying anytime you have a lot of police, that cuts in favor of finding custodial interrogation, is that right?
Correct. That is that's true.
Anytime somebody's present and a search warrant is being executed, their freedom of movement is restricted. And the Supreme Court's been clear about that. There's a case called Andressen versus Merlin back in the 80s or 70s, I think, that the obligation of anyone who is present on the premises at the time is to stand aside. They're not allowed to move from one room to the other. Now I take it that you wouldn't claim that if the person's not handcuffed and they're present when a search warrant is being executed, that their freedom of movement is restricted, and their freedom of movement is restricted, therefore they're in custody.
It's whether or not the freedom of movement is restrained to the degree associated with an arrest. Now, there are search warrant cases where the person is made to sit on a sofa in the living room and they're not handcuffed.
Right.
There are cases where everybody's put into the garage and they're allowed to move about the garage and they...
But they can't move around my point is that once a search warrant is being executed, you can't move. You're not free to move anywhere you want within the house or the apartment.
That's typically the case.
Right.
And you haven't mentioned this guy was huge, wore a 54 size jacket.
He was apparently a large.
How many of the officers were assigned to watch him? You said were there 10 officers?
There were 10 to 12. The testimony varied, but 10 to 12 officers.
And how many were assigned to him? So there are 10 to 12 going through the apartment, but how many were assigned to him?
Correct. Two officers were assigned to guard him.
Okay.
Was
he ever told that he could stop the interrogation at any time? In Howes, that was a pretty important factor.
There was no evidence that he was told he didn't have to answer the questions. The first statement in which he said, "Which bedroom is yours?" He essentially identified himself with both bedrooms by nodding to the left and saying he stayed at the right in the right bedroom. Next, after crack cocaine was found in the chair that he was sitting in, he responded. There was a back and forth exchange between Mr. Brinson Scott and Officer Sheegan in which he made statements and made admissions to the effect that he was from the ghetto. What did they expect him to do? He grew up in the neighborhood and he had no choice. And by making that statement, he essentially admitted that he was a drug dealer, that he knew that there were drugs in that apartment.
I want to be clear on the sequence. The first, I understand that which bedroom is yours. The second, I thought, was that's not mine. Or as the officer is pulling a yellow towel out of the bottom of the chair when he's told to stand up. And the third is the one you just described. Is that the sequence? I'm from the neighborhood. What do you want? What do you expect?
That's correct. That is the sequence of the statements.
The last two statements on their face related to the crack cocaine found in the chair, and he was not convicted of that.
The statements were made very, very soon after the crack, right after the crack cocaine was found in the chair. But I don't think that those statements can be limited to only what was found in the chair. By him saying that he was essentially saying, I have no choice. This is the neighborhood I live in. I live in a ghetto. I have no choice. He was admitting to being a drug dealer. Okay.
There's another wrinkle in this that you've left out of the equation, and if I understand it correctly, and that is that the testimony during the suppression hearing seemed to indicate that those statements were spontaneous utterances, not in response to questioning, whereas the statements that when the statements came out at trial, it was somewhat ambiguous, but it appeared to be in a give and take back and forth.
That's correct.
At least for the third statement. The second, though, I can't find where that was in response to a question. He said, "That's not mine." The police officer, the testimony was the chair's upside down. He's pulling a yellow towel out from the bottom that's got crack cocaine, and your client says, "That's not mine." But I don't find anything to indicate that that was in response to questioning.
The record did not parse out that that was in direct response to questioning. My part of the
The record does not support the proposition that it was in response to questioning. It appeared spontaneous. Isn't that correct? And if that's true, then we don't have to worry about the second statement because Miranda doesn't deal with spontaneous utterances.
You're talking about just the statement of
that's not mine.
Right. That isn't something that we're raising. I actually didn't count that as a separate statement.
So we've only got two. We've got the bedroom, that's my bedroom, or
yes.
Whatever. And the third one was?
The third one I was going to bring up was the statement that was actually suppressed when he was asked again, which bedroom is yours? And he responded, that he stays in the right but keeps some of his stuff in the left. And I brought that statement up. It was actually suppressed, and I brought that up to compare that statement with the very first statement about which bedroom he was in.
Yeah. I want to go back to what I'm calling the third, or you're calling
the
second, or whatever. One of the doctrines that has evolved under Miranda, on any kind of suppression hearing versus trial testimony, is that you have to renew the motion to suppress if the evidence that comes in tends to throw into doubt the validity of the district judge's refusal to suppress. If there's additional evidence that throws it into doubt, you as defense counsel have to renew your motion to suppress. Assume that that's the situation here. Assume that at the suppression hearing, this is much too long a question, but at the suppression hearing, it didn't appear that any of those statements were made in response to questioning, but at trial, the third one may have been. It was a give and take. But the doctrine that's evolved under Miranda is that if there's a strategic reason for defense counsel not to renew the suppression motion, then we can't consider that trial testimony.
I'm not sure.
And it seems to me there was a strategic reason why defense counsel wouldn't at that moment object. Because to do that and it is simply to highlight something that may have just flown over the jurors' heads. You know, what do you expect them from the ghetto or whatever? I mean, in hindsight, it may seem very incriminating, but in the heat of a trial, that's just one statement in a 4-day trial? Something like that. Why should we consider the trial testimony when there was no objection?
This is why it comes up as an ineffective assistance of counsel issue.
There is a strategic reason why defense counsel might not want to object and renew, because to do that would highlight that testimony. And it turns out, frankly, that defense counsel was right, because he was not convicted. He was not convicted of the crack cocaine charge.
As I recall that Officer Sheehan's testimony, when he was questioned, he was asked whether he made any statements to Mr. Brinson Scott, and he said yes. And at that point, there could have been an objection, and there should have been the objection should have been taken outside of the presence of the jury as to what the reasons for the objection.
I mean, even if you won, if it, on the third, I'm from the neighborhood, what do you expect? Even if after they approach the bench and the defense counsel renews his objection, and suppose the judge rules in defense counsel's favor, that, yeah, I'm going to order that suppressed. So what does the judge do? Instructs the jury, ladies and gentlemen, the jury, you just heard the defendant say, he's from the neighborhood, what do you expect? I want you to put that out of your mind. Don't consider that. I've granted a motion to strike that testimony. That really helps, doesn't it?
The question was, Officer Sheehan testified as to what he himself first said to Mr. Brinson Scott. He said it was almost right after the towel was found. He began to get agitated. It was all part of the game. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. This time we found it. No reason to get angry. It's not personal. And the hiding spot wasn't that good. No reason to get mad. Question, do you recall anything specific that he said to you? And so certainly there could have been an objection before the answer came.
All right, your time is up. We'll give you a minute and reply.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Stratton Strand on behalf of the government.
Am I wrong to consider that first question as simply put in the wrong way? In other words, what they were after was, which bedroom is your brother's bedroom?
Exactly.
I mean, they're looking for guns belonging to the brother. And rather than saying, which one's your brother's bedroom, they say, which one's your bedroom?
Right. And that's supported by the fact that Officer Nasser went immediately to the left bedroom, which was the bedroom that appellant had said was not his. That's why that question was asked.
How many bedrooms were there?
There were two.
Two. And so if he identifies which one's his,
then they know which one is not his, and that's the one so the question was asked to facilitate the orderly process of the search. As the court's questions have implied, the problem with appellant's argument is that handcuffing by itself cannot be dispositive.
No, it can't be dispositive, but in Howes, it's a significant factor, right?
Howes identifies handcuffing as one among several factors that are relevant to the initial step of the inquiry, whether there's been a freedom of movement curtailment. Howes makes
it seems to me. Let me tell you the two concerns I have to see if you can address them.
Yes, sir.
We're supposed to be looking at all these circumstances to see if a coercive environment is created, and. And it seems to me there are two facts that cut strongly against the government here. One, that he was handcuffed, and two, that he was never told, you don't have to submit to this question. Anytime you want to stop questioning, you can. Now, that was a critical factor in Howes. Why shouldn't that be a critical factor here?
We have the equivalent here. In Howes,
how so?
In Howes, the question was, we were talking about an imprisoned detainee,
right, yeah.
And so it wouldn't have been logical for them to tell him, "You're free to go."
No, but
you won't be arrested. You won't be arrested.
Right.
You're not under arrest. They wouldn't have said that to him. What they would say to him is, "You're free to leave." Here, where you have a non-incarcerated person, the relevant factor is, did they tell him he was under arrest? And here they specifically told him he was not under arrest. They specifically told him they were there just to execute a search warrant in relation to his brother, and they specifically told him that he would be given a copy of the search warrant when we're done with the search. All of those specific...
Did they also tell him why he was being handcuffed?
And they did. And they specifically told him, we're handcuffing you solely for officer safety.
Their quarrels, that's significant, right? His quarrels lets us know that if it's not for safety, then other factors come into play, right?
I believe it was Newton where the problem the court had in Newton was that the legitimate safety basis for the statement, this is just for your safety, wasn't conveyed to the defendant. Whereas here, this legitimate safety basis for the statement, for the handcuffing, was conveyed to him, and that was specifically, this is in regard to that incident with your brother, and he knew that the incident with his brother was the arrest for the gun in the waistband. So any reasonable person looking at the the totality of these circumstances is going to conclude that they'll be detained during the execution of the search warrant, any reasonable innocent person, they'll be detained during the execution of the search warrant, and when the search warrant is done, they will be allowed to go on their way. So for those reasons, the initial statement...
What's the significance of the fact that the officers told him that he could look at the search warrant after the search?
We'll give you a copy when we're done. Suggest this is going to be a temporary detention. This is not about you. We're just here to search the house, and when we're done, we'll give you...
But even if he were under arrest, he'd get that. I mean, that doesn't distinguish whether he's in the equivalent of an arrest situation or not, because the statute and the federal rules of criminal procedure require them to make a return. So what
it helps to identify an ending point that a reasonable person would say, you know.
Would you agree with me that regardless, that one person who's told you're under arrest and they're handcuffed, and another person who's just sitting there and not handcuffed, that both of them are entitled to a return if they're occupants of the premises?
Absolutely. And we're not playing primary reliance on that fact. The facts to us that are most significant are that he was specifically told that he was not under arrest, that the officers were there solely to execute a search warrant, which two circuits have recognized search warrant executions generally do not present the same type of coercive environment that Miranda's concerned about. And the fact that he was...
They don't unless you handcuff him, right? I mean,
well, but handcuffing cannot be the determinative factor. As Howes itself made clear, the court has to ask, quote, the additional question whether the relevant environment presents the same inherently coercive pressures as the station house questioning at issue in Miranda. And here the...
12 police officers descend on a two-bedroom apartment and handcuff the occupant. That's a reasonable person would not feel that they were in custody?
No, given the specific statements made by the officers explaining the situation. We're here to execute a search warrant. It's not about you. It's about your brother. You're not under arrest.
At the very least, you have to concede that had they done what was done in Howes, since that is, you can stop this questioning at any point in time. You'd have a stronger that would help your case.
Obviously. That would help, but that's not required. I mean, what is significant here is he was told he was not under arrest. He was told it was a search warrant, and he was told the reason for the handcuffing, and that reason was consistent with a temporary detention. In addition, we haven't even discussed all the other non-threatening aspects of this interaction. There was no forcible entry. The police knocked and announced. It was 3 p.m. He was seated in an easy chair in his own living room, which is not the type of course of circumstances with which we associate Miranda. He was asked a single question by a single officer within 5 minutes of the team's entry. And the testimony was that the tone of the interaction between him and the two officers who were standing there was very cordial. So under the totality of the circumstances, no reasonable, innocent person is going to say to themselves, at the end of this thing, I'm not going to be free to leave. A reasonable, innocent person is going to view this similarly to how a Terry stopped or a traffic stopped.
Yeah, your strongest argument, though, is that it didn't amount to a hill of beans.
Right.
That's not a legal concept, but that's the truth. I mean, they would have known that was his bedroom, whether he nodded that way or not. So.
Even if the statement was erroneously admitted, any error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, because the statement was used solely to show which bedroom was his, and there was a lot of other evidence, ample other evidence, as in Gaston.
And the jury showed its capacity to distinguish here, right?
By making...
Yeah.
As it turned out, when they did focus on him, when they did find the drugs, it's a good thing he was handcuffed because he lost it. I mean, he was sitting on the crack, and anyway...
He start kicked the Game Boy console. That's why you're allowed to handcuff an occupant of a search warrant residence when the search warrant is for guns.
What is there a general policy for when to handcuff during a search warrant and not?
By the police department?
Yeah.
The testimony at trial was that the usual procedure is to handcuff the occupants and to explain to them this is for your safety. Mm-hmm. You're not under arrest. We're simply here to execute a search warrant. And
is that right? Even what if you're executing a search warrant for documents or something
I don't, so let me not say more than I know. I was describing the testimony here. I don't know. The testimony here was that it's their usual procedure, but this was a guns and drugs unit, so presumably it was for that circumstance. So even if the statement was erroneously admitted, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt for the same reasons as in Gaston. There was ample other evidence that that bedroom was the appellant's. If I could briefly address the ineffective assistance claim, here, as Judge Randolph's question suggested, first of all, there was no deficiency because there were strategic reasons not to renew that motion in the middle of trial. And even getting beyond the deficiency prong to the prejudice prong, appellant has failed to show a substantial likelihood of a different verdict here.
How did this judge conduct the objections? Something like this, would the jury be dismissed and then open court argument, or would it be up at the bench with one of those sound suppressors on, or what?
The objections were taken at the bench. Okay. When counsel asked to approach,
right.
Otherwise they were in open court. Even if you get to the prejudice prong, which we don't believe you need to, the jury, as Your Honor's question suggested, failed to convict on the count on the drugs to which that statement related. The statement was made immediately after those drugs were found. And tellingly, appellant was not aware at the time he made that statement that the powder cocaine had been found in his bedroom. So it obviously related only to that crack. Yeah. And the government only argued it that way. The government said that in explaining why it had proven its quid crack charge, the government said one of the things you should look at is when the crack was found, he said, quote, specifically about these drugs, what else was I supposed to do? What else am I supposed to do? I've got no choice. So even the government relied on it only to prove the crack charge, and the jury failed to acquit. So it obviously didn't have any significant benefit.
We know he wasn't aware that they found the coke in the bedroom.
He was not aware.
How do we know he wasn't aware? They found a mask and they found all. Isn't that where they found all the other paraphernalia?
The mask and the money were found in the right bedroom. The powder cocaine was found in the left bedroom, which was his. But the testimony from Officer Nasser was that once he found the powder cocaine, he did not inform appellant. Nobody informed appellant that had been found.
Where was it located?
In the pocket of a very large size jacket in the closet.
He had to assume that they're going to find it.
In any event, I don't know whether that's a reasonable assumption or not. It may be. But even if it was, the government, I think the most telling thing is that that's how the government argued it. The government argued it only as to the crack charge. It didn't argue it as evidence of the cocaine charge. And the jury obviously wasn't particularly impressed by it because it hung on the crack charge.
But we don't know if the reason they hung was a compromise verdict, yeah. or because they thought the evidence was insufficient. I mean, there's no way of knowing that, right? How much can you make of that they hung on the crack charge?
Well, they obviously weren't impressed by that statement. That statement wasn't sufficient to tip the balance for them on the charge to which it specifically related.
They could have said, look, you know, the guy, he's from the neighborhood, and there are two counts against him. One's crack and one's cocaine powder. So let's just convict them of the one.
Here, of course, in the ineffective assistance context, the burden is on the appellant to show a substantial likelihood of a different result absent this evidence. And the appellant can't do that under these circumstances, particularly because there was ample other evidence to support both the constructive possession of the powder cocaine and the intent to distribute. The amount of the powder cocaine was enough for 800 servings, which is inconsistent with...
Do you read, I probably should ask your learned colleague here the question, but do you read the defendant's brief as arguing that the testimony at the suppression hearing was was sufficient for the judge to have suppressed the statement about the neighborhood? Or is the argument instead that you have to consider the trial testimony as well?
I read appellant's brief as saying that you have to consider the trial testimony, that it was only the trial testimony that called into doubt the validity of the trial court's
suppression. Because otherwise it wasn't in response to questioning the way it was presented at the suppression hearing, is that right?
I think that's their argument. But another response to that, of course, is that the trial court's reasoning was for not suppressing that statement was twofold. It was not only that it was a spontaneous statement, but that he still wasn't in custody at the time. He was only in custody once the statement was made. So from the perspective of a competent trial attorney, the fact that it may have been uttered in response to some sort of statement eliciting question wouldn't have changed the second basis for the trial court's ruling, which was that he still wasn't in custody until after that statement was made. So a reasonable defense attorney would have had no reason to renew the motion. Right. For those reasons, we would ask that Your Honors affirm.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Why don't you take, 1 minute.
I'd like to use my time addressing the prejudice part of this case. There seems to be an assumption that there's so much other evidence that would have convicted Mr. Brinson Scott anyway of possession of the cocaine found in the bedroom, and that there's so much evidence that the left bedroom was his bedroom. First of all, the question, which bedroom is yours, presumes that he has a bedroom in that apartment. What was the evidence of him, and the government spent some time and put in evidence trying to show that this was his address where he lived. And that's
he was on the lease, he and his brother.
This lease was dated 2006. The search happened in 2008.
So what? Is there a later lease?
Well,
I mean, it told them the brother lived there. Why didn't it tell them that this fella lived there?
That's correct. And, well, there was evidence there, a lot of which could have been explained. In other words, there was a lease, and people are on a lease, but they don't always necessarily live there. There were 10 to 15 items of clothing in this closet, and yet, what would that be? Maybe 10 tops, 10 bottoms. Most people at a permit address in their closet will have more clothing than that, if that is really where they live. The other items that were introduced supposedly showing that he lived there, an ID card that follows a person wherever they go, and he was in that apartment on that day, a vehicle title and a traffic citation, both things that someone might have pulled out of their pockets, and critically, those two documents did not list that apartment as Mr. Brinson Scott's address. And so if he had been, and if he could have been a temporary guest at that apartment, I think that the government's evidence that he was responsible for some of the drugs there would have been much more tenuous. Those statements, he said, he admitted that he essentially lived there, and he admitted that he was a drug dealer and that he had no choice but to deal in drugs. In closing, we will submit, as far as the third sentencing argument, Mr. Brinson Scott's statements were admitted in violation of his Fifth Amendment right. We did not raise a Fourth Amendment issue. This was a Fifth Amendment issue.
I want to ask you the same question I asked the Assistant U.S. Attorney. I'm from the neighborhood, what do you expect question?
At the suppression hearing, it appeared that was a spontaneous statement, not in response to questioning.
That's correct.
your argument on appeal is, with respect to that statement, is solely on the basis that counsel should have renewed the motion to suppress in light of testimony indicating it wasn't spontaneous.
That's correct.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Call the next case.